and welcome to the Partners in FinCrime podcast in association with FSCom. My name's Evan McGugan.
And I'm Chris Vaughan.
In this podcast series, we'll be looking to discuss all things anti-financial crime.
We'll be deep diving into cutting-edge stories, as well as other interesting topics in the financial crime space.
In this episode, we talk about politically exposed persons, on how banks and financial institutions should treat them, and then more recently, the ongoing case between Coutts Bank and Nigel Farage. Hey Chris, how are you?
Hello there, how are you?
Yeah, not too bad, thanks. Not too bad at all. I know I ask this every time we start, but anything new with you?
You do indeed. Nothing massive, to be fair, although I think you've just been away, haven't you? How was the break?
Yeah, it was really good. At the point of recording, it was 2 weeks ago now, so the tan, or at least what tan there was, has pretty roundly disappeared. But yeah, wee week in Cyprus, bit of sun, bit of sea, lots of halloumi, and lots of like Greek and Roman architecture. So what more could you really ask for in a holiday?
Lovely stuff. That's what you need. Recharge those batteries.
So I guess it's been a bit of a mad month, a particularly busy July with financial crime news and related stories. We've seen a real focus on PEPs, on politically exposed persons across that. And that's really been under the lens of how banks, how regulated firms, financial institutions should be and are treating PEPs and really financial inclusion too, and how that all sort of meshes together. The driver for this, I guess, is of course Nigel Farage, and I guess for anybody who isn't aware, you know, former MEP, former leader of UKIP, former leader of the Brexit Party, and probably relevant to this discussion, former client of Coutts. The crux of the story seems to have been that Farage really contends that he was exited by Coutts Bank on the basis of his political views. That was initially denied by Coutts, but this whole story has sort of rumbled on, and it's really hit the mainstream media, the Daily Mail, who everybody obviously loves, but even the BBC, reputable news agencies have really picked this up, and PEPs have sort of entered that popular zeitgeist over the past wee bit. So I guess that maybe we should focus on that and what it means and what we can draw out from that. So maybe let's get into that in a wee bit. But first off, shall we talk PEPs in general, Chris?
Yeah, we can do, definitely. I think that's probably a good place to start, actually, because if we contextualize what we actually mean by a PEP, I think that'll give us a good grounding for the story, because it is a really interesting one. And there's been quite a lot of back and forth and controversy to some degree, but also just discussion. And it's really, because it sort of sits in a grey area, this story, and the way it's been treated by the media is always quite polarized. It might be an interesting one to tackle. So yeah, let's start with PEPs then. Do you want to go ahead, and we can go back and forth?
Absolutely, cool. Yeah, so PEP, politically exposed person, is it FATF recommendation? I know we did this 3 or 4 episodes ago. Correct name, I think it's recommendation 12. You can fact check me. The PEP definition ultimately comes from the FATF recommendations, and it defines it as really an individual who is or has been entrusted with public prominent function, somebody who holds influence through their position. And in the UK, it's set out in MLR's 2017 what sort of positions might be defined as holding that prominent function. I wouldn't probably attempt to rhyme them all off right now, but it's the likes of heads of state, heads of government, members of parliament, members of Supreme Courts, governing bodies of political parties, ambassadors, members of state-owned enterprises, and so on. There's quite a defined list of what the UK considers to be PEPs. It also includes family members of people who fit that definition. So spouses, civil partners, children of Peps, and then also, you know, parents and known close associates. So those who hold, you know, close business relationships with Peps or sort of joint beneficial ownership in entities that are set up to benefit Peps. I guess the risk really that is presented by Peps is that, well, they're perceived to potentially be at more risk of using their position for abuse of that position. So the risk from a firm might be that they would enter into a business relationship for the purposes of laundering illicit funds or, you know, laundering the proceeds of corruption, bribery, all that good stuff. And really, as a result, firms are ultimately obliged to apply enhanced due diligence when entering into a business relationship with a PEP. So that's, I guess, what a PEP is in the UK and some of the roundabout definitions and so on. I wonder, Chris, do you maybe want to pick up from there and talk about what enhanced due diligence exactly means for PEPs? What do we say when firms need to apply enhanced measures to enter or continue a business relationship? What does that look like?
Yeah, exactly. So that is super helpful, and it's always best to start, I think, at the beginning, like you've done there with the FATA 40, which is where all of the regs on money laundering essentially stem from, right? But, you know, we get that PEPs are gonna pose our firm a higher risk than other potential customers will. There's all sorts of reasons for that that Evan's just outlined there. But then on top of that, there's then going to be stipulated mandatory enhanced due diligence that will need to be applied to anyone who is identified as a PEP. So I suppose there's a couple of pieces that go into this. Maybe before we get to the enhanced due diligence piece, it's first of all, how do you determine if your customer is or is not a PEP? And there's various means, but most people in the AML world know and have done some form of or have touched some form of screening. So I think screening, the term maybe is most associated with sanctions, but obviously there is also PEP screening, which is essentially just running your customer's name against a database of known politically exposed people and associates. Worth mentioning that it is not just PEPs themselves who would be relevant here, but also associates, known family members and things like that all fall into this definition. So first of all, you'd be conducting a screening of your clients. Your screening systems will then throw up potential matches for you to investigate. So you then look basically against the potential matches. And then ultimately, if you are then, you know, you figure out, oh, this is an actual true match, you know, on a number of different data points, you've matched your customer to PEP, there's then some things that are going to have to apply. So there is stipulated mandatory measures that you have to apply to PEPs that are different to how you handle other types of enhanced due diligence. This is set out in different laws, you know, around the world, but in sort of the EU directives, and then within UK law as well, you've got different ways of treating PEPs. But broadly, to be honest, it's very similar across jurisdictions. What are some of those measures? So probably the most important one that people will always remember when it comes to PEPs will be source of funds and source of wealth. So that's sort of the main one that everyone's heard of. If you know, like I say, if you run in these AML circles, maybe. And I suppose we could go into that in a bit more depth. We have actually discussed source of funds, source of wealth a little bit before on previous episodes. But broadly speaking, source of funds would be what is the source of the funds that you are bringing to the transaction, to a specific transaction on a platform, for example. Where have those funds come from? So it could be a bank, you know, a different bank, a different institution. Is it from sale of a house, or is it inheritance, or whatever that might be? So that's funding a very specific thing. And then source of wealth is more broadly how the person came into their total wealth. So you'd want to get an idea of a person's total net worth, and then broadly speaking, you know, how they acquired their wealth over their lifetime. So it could be businesses, inheritances, these kinds of things as well. So that's how it works. And there are other, you know, source of funds, source of wealth, not the only EDD measure. There are other EDD measures that need to be applied. Another notable one is MLRO sign-off. when you're identified as a PEP, if you're a customer of an institution and you are identified as a PEP, your application will then always be passed through over the eyes of the MLRO, basically, who would decide whether or not you fall within risk appetite for that firm. Obviously, different PEPs have different levels of potential risk. Quite clearly, heads of state, for example, are going to pose higher risk than just a sort of a local official, for example, or other lower tier PEPs. And for this purpose, PEPs you'll often find are graded into levels. These aren't official levels, I should say, but quite a lot of screening providers that you will work with actually categorize the different levels of PEP. So a level one PEP, for example, or tier one PEP would be someone who poses quite a high risk. And then, you've got 3, 4 lower down would be lower risk PEPs. The measures there would then be more risk-based, I guess. So, what's required is that you do an assessment of the risk that the PEP poses. All of that would then be captured and then would need MLRO approval as well. So yeah, that's a few of the measures. Am I missing anything there, Evan?
No, I think you've pretty much covered it. I think always a really interesting and important point to remember on the idea that not all PEPs are equal. Like you'll have your PEP class one to take X screening provider, and then 2, 3, 4 all the way down to local level. It's the essence of any effective risk-based approach, I guess. You don't want to treat all PEPs as the same. You might, for example, see a head of state in an EU country is presenting the same risk as a PEP class 2 or a PEP class 3 in a country that maybe has lesser systemic or national anti-corruption legislation, regulation, laws, and all that good stuff. So yeah, I think that's a key point to make. And then yeah, as you say, you do your screen related parties as well, related to corporates if you're in the business of corporates. So you'd be talking about UBOs, you'd be talking about directors, you'd be talking about signatories potentially, you'd be talking about significant controllers in ways of control outside of just pure ownership to potentially determine political exposure where it may exist. And then as you say, you've got the controls that you need to apply where you have identified one as a true match. And probably pertinent to the discussion we'll probably come on to, but the point of collecting source of funds, source of wealth, of getting your sign off, of conducting enhanced ongoing monitoring of that business relationship, is that the collection of all that, the verification of all that, is very preventive in nature. It's not to say that all PEPs are necessarily involved in criminal activity, but this is how we determine whether that is or isn't the case. So you'll go and understand the exposures and then ensure that you can effectively mitigate that. And you do sort of see that in that definition that we sort of set out at the start of this as well. But like some manners of PEP, member of parliament, you could quite easily see how the perception might be, lobbying, bribery, trying to exercise their influence for financial gain, that sort of makes sense. But equally, when you go down through courts and whatnot, any sort of involvement in the public purse or being able to influence laws, that's how it may sort of manifest. But that, I guess, that's what you sort of have to do to mitigate the risk.
Yeah, exactly. I think what's interesting that's come out of this particular story, which I think we should probably touch on here, is also that while we've covered the broad strokes there, I think, of what PEPs are and why they matter and how they potentially are treated, within the sphere of anti-financial crime. I fear that this isn't a broadly well understood piece when it comes to sort of your general man on the street or a consumer who's just using, a financial institution as you would, your own bank, or if you use the services of a fintech or someone like this. I think it's really highlighted this particular case and this story involving Nigel Farage, how little of the inner workings of AML is really understood by the wider public. I think quite often, certainly when I first got into financial crime, was quite surprised that didn't really know that compliance sort of existed behind the scenes. And I think there is quite a bit of that because, there's not really the need for your normal everyday citizen to understand exactly what compliance measures are and what a PEP is and why it means anything to them. Because for the most part, PEPs are very few and far between, of course. In terms of your broader customer base, you're probably only going to have a handful in comparison to your total book. So this has come out anyway as part of this story, of course, and I think it's led to some confusions, maybe certainly a little bit of misinterpretation and things like that, where the reason behind some of these measures is not quite understood, I think. So it might be cool to sort of unpack that a little bit in regards to this particular story. Do you want to sort of set the scene a bit?
Yeah, grand job. Sounds good to me. So I guess in essence, Nigel Farage ultimately alleged that Coutts had terminated the business relationship that they held with him due to his political views, personally held political views. I think at the outset, this was initially refuted by the bank. They ultimately claimed that Nigel Farage was exited due to no longer meeting their internal economic criteria for holding an account, which, you know, Coutts, it's the, you know, the Queen's banker. It's a bank that predominantly focuses on high net worth and ultra high net worth individuals. You essentially have to have something along the lines of like £1 million pound sterling, or you have to plan to borrow or invest in £1 million with Coutts to even get an account or maintain an account. So that was the initial, you know, refutation, for want of a better word, from the bank. And that was widely reported. Thereafter, Farage submitted a subject access request to Coutts. So you'll remember, you know, under GDPR and now, you know, the UK Data Protection Act, you have that ability to go and reach out to firms who hold your data to request all the information they hold on you. He went and submitted SR, and yeah, subject access request, not suspicious activity report, submitted a subject access request to Coutts to obtain really all the internal Coutts communication on his eventual exiting, which then led to the release of a 40-page dossier from Coutts' own reputational risk committee, which essentially set out the considerations that Coutts had been looking at as far back as 2018. It's a pretty fascinating read, although I would maybe hesitate to use the word fascinating, because the conversations detailed, to your point, on the layman maybe finding this to be, you know, quite scandalous, it's really probably not that alien to anybody who has sat in such committees or has had to make similar decisions and determinations. The crux of that whole document appears to relate to the identification of what is perceived to be adverse press relating to Farage. And I wouldn't be making any personal statements here or, you know, political views of my own, but the document refers to certain statements that it perceived to be not in line with the bank's own values, the bank's own mission, purpose, and so on. So Brexit, pro-Russian sentiment, allegedly, climate denial, that type of stuff. It is also interesting, though, because the bank state that there is no evidence of any legal or regulatory censure for any of these points. It's all sort of open source information, political statements that Nigel Farage has made rather than any convictions or anything like that. They also state there's no evidence of direct Russian regime connection outside of appearance fees on RT, and that Farage actually has been very professional in his dealings with Coutts, that he's polite and respectful in his engagement with staff. The dossier is quite sort of dense on evidence, so Twitter feed links and all that good stuff, but ultimately sort of contends that once Nigel Farage's mortgage expires, he would then no longer meet the economic criteria for holding an account with them, and the determination of the exiting of the relationship should be on a glide path aligning to this. So the main driver, seems to me, for this exit decision was an assessment of the reputational risk of these statements not aligning with the bank's values, not aligning with Coutts' own values and purpose, falling outside of the economic criteria, and then the bank ultimately just not really wanting to make an exception to continue to bank Farage because of that reputational risk as they perceived it to be. So, very long-winded way of setting out that it seems that the decision is both commercial, but also driven by Coutts' own reputational risk appetite, and really based on the outputs of Farage's own political statements in the public arena. So that's my summary of what that dossier contains, from my point of view anyway, and where we are at the point of recording. Any instant thoughts or feedback on that timeline and your perception, Chris?
No, I think that's good. I think we're getting towards the crux of the matter. But before I touch on that, I just want to also flesh out a little bit. A reputational risk committee. So it probably worth explaining a little bit what, obviously I don't know the inner workings of Coutts or how it happens, but it's worth discussing what these kinds of committees within, actually these kinds of committees, like risk committees in general, there are all sorts of different types of risk committees, but they point towards good risk governance and management, really. They form part of a good risk management framework, and really what these committees do is they sort of meet, and there'll be different people from around the business who might have sort of a vested interest in a particular customer case. So a customer may come up as part of one of these committees for a number of reasons. Sometimes it may be due to a periodic review because the customer account has been on book for a certain amount of time and needs to be looked at again. Maybe they need the KYC information updating, or further information is required, or it may be due to an event-driven piece, which means that something has happened during the course of the relationship, which gives the bank or the financial institution reason to go back and review the account. So I don't know whether in the documents it's detailed at the reason why this has come under review, but it's usually one of these kinds of things. And then what happens is there'll be a review that's conducted that, in this case, obviously put together quite a sizable dossier on that. And then that is usually taken to a committee where you'll have probably the risk teams, you'll probably have someone representing financial crime, you'll have someone representing sort of the commercial side of the business, and quite often, senior stakeholders, sometimes board members, depending on the size of the institution. They will sit and at a minuted meeting discuss what they think is the best outcome. So I think worth contextualizing with that, first of all, there's all sorts of different types of risk committees that happen, and they're actually really a good thing, certainly for risk management and governance. So that's the first thing, I think. And then what I think really where we're going in terms of the crux of what we're talking about, like the central issue here, is so from the bank side of things, obviously they have their own risk appetite, and they have a reputation to consider, and reputational risk is an important part of overall sort of risk posed to a firm, and there are commercial aspects, and they kind of have the right to say no to whoever they want, in a sense. They're just as any firm could deny services to someone for whatever reason, the bank has that right. But then on the other side of things is, was this particular instance, are individuals at risk of having their bank accounts closed because they have a certain political position? And that's the way that it's seen from the other side of the fence. So that, I think that's the central crux here, and that's the one where there's been quite a lot of back and forth, and people not really, there is sort of a lot of political baggage that kind of comes into this, and I don't want to bring that in, but that's really, I think, the crux of the issue here, and where the rubber hits the road in terms of why this has become a big issue and why it's been so publicised. Interestingly, just before I throw back to you, Evan, subject access requests. I think Nigel Farage has actually sort of put this on the radar for a lot of people. And as far as we can tell from recent reports, there's been a deluge of subject access requests to different banking institutions now, just purely on the back of this, to sort of get hold of some of the information that banks are holding on customers. Not saying that's a good or a bad thing, but is certainly an interesting development. I guess people always had this ability. They just didn't really know about it. They always had this right, but it just wasn't on their radar. And now I think that it's becoming much more, well, certainly this case and this story's drawn massive attention to that. So yeah, certainly an interesting development anyway. What do you think on that then? To go back to the main crux of the story, what's your thoughts on that? Is anyone in the right here, or is it just a grey area?
I think it's definitely a grey area. I think reputational risk's always going to be quite a difficult one. It's sort of inherently subjective, and like any risk appetite, and you're spot on to sort of point out there's all sorts of different risks that the banks and FIs are exposed to, legal, financial, regulatory, so on and so forth. And like any risk appetite, it's going to vary from firm to firm. So, you know, you might have a very ethically driven bank, for example, that doesn't, you know, want to invest in, I have to think of something that isn't illegal, but unsavory, adult entertainment. I know certainly firms may choose to not service an adult entertainment platform on the basis of reputational risk because they don't want to then potentially be seen as the payment processor for that industry, ignoring the difficulties in mitigating the risk. But it's a very valid position to take. So that is that, you know, it's inherently subjective and it is difficult. I guess Coutts tried to align it to their stated values, their mission statements, and having it go through this reputational risk committee is an indicator of good governance. And whilst there is some probably inflammatory language used in it, quote unquote, disingenuous grifter, and I'm sure, you know, that was in inverted commas too in the document, and I'm sure people didn't write that expecting it would go out into the public domain, which is sort of a difficult one as well. But it is sort of an indicator of good governance otherwise around that. And banks should ultimately really have the right to reject business on a reputational standpoint if they see that. I guess where it gets difficult, though, is where it's an individual we're talking about and not a business. It's a lot easier to reject a business on reputational ground than an individual, and particularly when it's based on the political statements of an individual, that can then sort of become muddy water. The dossier actually makes a very interesting point too, which is that probably a lot of their clients hold similar views or views that the bank wouldn't find savoury. It's just Nigel Farage has that public position to be able to air them. So the only reason they're aware of this disparity between what they perceive to be Farage's position and theirs is because of who he is. But then again, everything's case by case anyway, so you have to ultimately treat it as such. But yeah, it is a difficult one. I think there's no right or wrong answer. I think it seems like the bank tried to go about it the right way. Farage did come down outside of the economic criteria they hold for clients, and then they chose to exit him when his facility had closed on the mortgage. So yeah, you can potentially see how they made that decision. It's a difficult one.
Yeah, it definitely is. That definitely is difficult. I think there's a couple of things maybe to touch on further there. So, you know, I agree with everything you've said there. I think the only thing to think about is what if all banks were to do this, first of all. So a couple of situations. One, I think banks perhaps have a different responsibility than, let's say, a fintech or another rival product. You know, there's sort of the free marketplace, let's say, at work there. If you were to be denied by one bank, okay, then you just go to the next one. But you are sort of, I guess, going into a certain territory there where it ends up being that, you know, a customer can't find a bank, but has done no wrong or committed committed no crime. And I think that's quite a difficult one to treat. But then are you also saying that banks are obliged to deal with customers? That's also a difficult piece, like not necessarily. I think we've maybe strayed away from PEPs a little bit here, but I think the treatment of PEPs is actually quite an interesting one as sort of a sideline or a tangent from this, because I think some firms will just take the stance that PEPs are just outside of their appetite.
Yeah, yeah.
It's not uncommon, I suppose, to see that across the financial services industry, and I wonder if maybe there's scope for sort of rethinking that position, really, you know, because yes, there is an enhanced risk, but you know, we really should be outfitted as compliance teams to be able to handle these kinds of risks. And I think as long as you're able to put in the right measures and the right checks and balances, and the compliance outfits are well resourced and have a good overall risk management approach. I don't think there's any reason why you would just need to outlaw PEPs entirely as, you know, as outside of your risk appetite. So I think that's definitely an interesting point. It's typical of me to bring this up, but things like typically cryptocurrency, one of the reasons why crypto was actually first founded was to take these kinds of decisions out of the hands of centralized authorities like banks. So it is interesting, you know, I'm not saying that this is the case in this situation, by the way, but you could imagine a situation in which individuals were denied banking access because they weren't savory, you know, perhaps in some particular, they weren't deemed savory, I should say, you know, perhaps in another country where there was a dictatorship or something of this ilk, you could see someone being locked out of financial services. So I think crypto sort of has been a way for people to hold funds without needing that approval or that centralized authority to say yes or no. You know, no one screening you or telling you that you're not the right person with the right opinions who can get access to financial services. So I think that's also an interesting thing to think about. But
I was wondering how long we'd get in before mention of crypto. We must have made it about half an hour. So
that's a record for me, I think, on this podcast.
I was wondering when it was coming. You're spot on. No one on mentioning that crypto mission statement, really, and the benefits of that in the most altruistic sort of form of ensuring people don't get locked out unduly. I know the FCA certainly expects firms wouldn't decline or close business relationships just because you're a PEP. Supposedly they're going to be tightening rules now on that. I think it was sort of a rule anyway, or at least it was guidance that you shouldn't be. It should be based on risk assessment. And as you say, if you can't mitigate the risk, you sort of have to, you know, have a look, see if you can. If you can't, then it's okay, but you shouldn't just be sort of declining or closing if somebody is a PEP. But it is potentially dangerous ground if people are being rejected. Bank accounts, which you need to contribute, live in 2023. If you're getting locked out of that, then that is potentially problematic. There is obviously, I think there's a right to bank accounts in some regard, but maybe not to premium bank accounts where you have to hold a million. Because I think, if I recall, he was offered an account with NatWest.
No, 100%. Yeah, you're right, actually, and that is an important point. I think overall, so there's a couple of the developments, isn't there? There's, first of all, NatWest have actually apologized to Nigel Farage in this instance. There's the thing I mentioned already, which is the huge influx of subject access requests, which are apparently coming into banks at the moment. And then I think also there was something tabled at the Commons. Am I right?
Yeah, so new Treasury proposal, still to obviously go through the motions and get ratified and whatnot, but proposals to give customers 90 days notice now before account closures, before downgrading of services. Also, firms will have to spell out why they're terminating bank accounts, sort of boosting transparency is what the Treasury says, and quote-unquote aiding their efforts to overturn decisions. So you should be expecting to see where your account has been closed for non-financial crime concern, good sort of rationale as to why your account's been closed. And I think that's probably a good thing. You know, Consumer Duty is obviously coming in quite soon in the UK, and you're not going to ever be able to tell people whose accounts you're closing for financial crime reasons. You're never going to be able to tell them why that is because of all the usual wrinkles under POCA. But as messy as this story probably is, boosting transparency for exited clients when there previously wouldn't have been that transparent is maybe a good thing, but we'll have to watch that space. I think it's just proposals at the minute, but the government definitely moved very swiftly on this. We see how noisy this story was, so you can see how that's happened.
Yeah, definitely. It's definitely caused a wave of interest. Never heard the words subject access request so much in my life as of recent. And everyone's been talking about PEPs and things. So it is interesting, certainly, to see some of the buzzwords that we use every single day get thrown about on the news, which is always interesting. I wonder if to sort of close off on this, maybe it'd be interesting to hear, you know, in terms of a firm dealing with a PEP, we sort of outlined at the beginning, you know, identification and then EDD measures. In just because it's sort of related to the story, in terms of ongoing management of PEP risk, like what do you think are some sort of principles we could set out? What does handling PEPs on an ongoing basis look like? You know, what does good look like in that arena?
Yeah, so I guess it's obviously going to vary based on like what the firm does, what its exposures are, what its products are, and so forth. But the regulatory obligation once you're in the door is to conduct enhanced ongoing monitoring of that business relationship. So in the most simple terms, you're obviously going to have to do more frequent periodic reviews. You're going to have more frequent touch points with that business relationship, be that transactional or be that, you know, customer outreach and everything else. I think previously what we used to see was moving on to the 1 year periodic review cycle and firms sort of seeing that as sufficient. I think now, and it's sort of hard to set out what good looks like here, but I think you're going to want to have very tailored TM thresholds, very tailored TM controls to the risk posed. You're going to want to keep an eye on obviously specific transactional indicators that may reflect that or indicate towards some sort of risk manifestation, and generally just keep a close eye on them, have them on your PEP register, your PEP log, review them on a regular basis, and make sure you continue to be happy with them. What do you think is any other points from your perspective?
No, yeah, I think that's right. I think all of that makes perfect sense. Yeah, I was going to mention PEP register, I think, as well, because that's something we didn't mention in the outset. We'd expect firms to have a log of PEPs that they've got on book, and sort of be actively managing that risk very purposefully, as you say, with tailored measures. Probably 10 times out of 10, a PEP customer will be high risk. Like that's just the way it is. They'll be registered as high risk within the system, which means more frequent reviews, and just, yes, generally increasing scrutiny, understanding what your customer is using the account for, whether the scope of activity still falls within the expected nature of the relationship. Really, it's a really interesting one, as I say, but hopefully that's helped a little bit, I suppose, from the AML side to kind of bring out that side of it, because I think, as I say, in this story in particular, I've seen quite a lot of perhaps misconstrued pieces, misunderstandings, that seeming that this was a targeted attack by the bank or whatever it was. But I think hopefully that's given a bit of an insight into what actually these processes do look at and how risk is managed at a financial institution, or certainly how it should be. There is still a grey area in there, which is an interesting one to talk about. But nonetheless, I think it is an interesting story. What do you think? Any final pieces?
No, agreed. Very interesting story. And I'm sure at the point of recording, the story hasn't quite run its course.
I think you might be right.
We'll see where it goes.
Well, all right then. So I think that's us for this week. It's been great catching up as usual. Appreciate your time. I love talking around this stuff. Yep. And thanks everyone for listening. I think we'll see you next time.
Likewise. See you later.
We hope you enjoyed this episode of the Partners in FinCrime podcast. If you want to get in touch with the podcast or for more information on governance, risk and compliance related matters, please reach out on our website at fscom.co or alternatively, send us an email at partnersinfincrime@fscom.co. That's partnersinfincrime@fscom.co.